I'm Peter Marks from The Washington Post.
I'm Terry Teachout from The Wall Street Journal.
And I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli. You can read me in publications like The New York Times, The New Yorker, and Newsday. Welcome to the second episode of Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York about theater in America. We're hosted by American Theater Magazine, a publication of the Theater Communications Group. Well, gentlemen, here we are. We're back. We made it. We survived somehow.
Is that what we are?
We're ready to chat about theater again. So after our first episode, which I'm now referring to as season one, episode one, because I'm that kind of girl.
It was the pilot.
Was an introduction, but now we're going to, this one will be more about what we really, the format we want to do in the future, which means that we'll have a couple of segments, and it'll be more representative of the kind of conversation we want to have about theater and with the theater people who make theater, because today we're going to have a very special guest. And I'm very excited about that because I have never seen her on stage.
Boy, are you missing something.
Also, I hear.
But about whom more later?
And we actually, we have another segment besides the very special guest. And Jerry, if you could tell us a bit about that.
Today, we're going to take a look at the problem of rising ticket prices, especially on Broadway. Hamilton set stratospheric new standards just a couple of years ago, but now, with Bette Midler in Hello, Dolly! And Bruce Springsteen on Broadway, we're living in a world where $800 and $900 orchestra seats have become the new normal.
But before we get to the depressing part, and I really am saying depressing because I cannot find a positive side.
I don't think there are any producers
this
in this room, no.
Yeah, there's some very rich people. That's
there are, the but upside. For the 10 people out there who are really making a mint out of this, well, we want to talk about one of the people who make theater what it is, the people who make us happy. And in fact, we're going to talk with one of them, and that is Holly Twyford, who's an actress based in Washington, D.C. And before we get on the phone with her, Peter, could you tell us a little bit about Holly?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, one of the great joys of being a critic in a city like Washington is that you forge these kind of astonishing relationships all one way. And one of the great ones for me over the years of developing a kind of conversation with the public about has been Holly Twyford. Holly is, what can I tell you? You know, she is a revered actress in D.C., and any production that Holly is a part of, virtually, is a gold-plated production. I've seen her do, the range is kind of astonishing. Old Times by Harold Pinter, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf by Albee, As Bees in Honey Drown by Douglas Carter Bean, Arcadia by Tom Stoppard, Lost in Yonkers by Neil Simon, and it's always new and interesting and rewarding to watch her work. So it is a pleasure to get to talk to her on Three on the Isle.
I have a different perspective, obviously. I'm a New York-based critic, but I cover theater all over the United States. I happened to go down to Washington to see the Folger Theater's production of Tom Stoppard's Arcadia, in which Holly Twyford performed. And it was a jaw-dropper. And I said to myself, whatever this woman does next, I'm seeing it. And what it was Harold Pinter's Old Times at the Shakespeare Theater. After that, I put her on a very short list I have of regional actors I will travel to see.
Mm.
So that's my experience.
Good for you.
With her.
I endorse that. And most recently, Holly did something that was sort of not expected from her out of her wheelhouse. She played Desiree Armfelt in Signature Theater's really, really terrific revival of A Little Night Music, Sondheim's and Hugh Wheeler's great adaptation of the Bergman film.
Right, that's Signature Theater in Arlington, Virginia.
Right, it's the Signature Theater that has won a Tony Award, a regional Tony Award. So, and it proved that Holly has an instrument that can be redefined again and again.
So are you blushing there in Washington, Holly? Are you
yeah.
Are you liking this?
Can we just stop now? That all sounds great. And it's great talking to you guys. So
okay, now we get down to business.
So Holly, you know, maybe start by describing for people. What's a typical year, a typical season for you like? What's the range of things that happens in the course of any given season in Washington?
Well, I'm actually taking a little time off. I'm going to be directing a play we open in February, and it's Becoming Dr. Ruth at Theater J with Naomi Jacobson doing her first one-woman show.
How exciting. So
I wanted to be extra prepared to work with somebody of Naomi's caliber. And so I sort of said, hey, listen, after Little Night Music, I'm going to take a little time and just be with my family. And it's turning into a little bit of a break, actually.
Well, I'd say last year, how many shows, how many performances did you do last season?
Roughly. Last season, Midsummer Night's Dream. I did Midsummer Night's Dream. I played Bottom.
I'd have paid money to see that.
Oh, my God.
Then, I didn't have to.
And then I think that there was nothing in between that and Virginia Woolf. And then I did a play called Or at Roundhouse Theater. And then A Little Night Music. So it was a full season of some really fun roles and just one really great experience after the next.
Do you find that kind of variety is typical of working in regional theater, going from so many different kinds of roles?
I try to take risks. That's absolutely what Virginia Woolf was. It's absolutely what A Little Night Music was. And so that often involves variety. And I've been very, very fortunate in the opportunities that have been offered to me, because I am able to say, this is something that really scares the heck out of me. So I should probably do it.
Holly, can you make a living? Can you support yourself or your family on an actor's salary in Washington?
No.
Can you
do that anywhere?
No. That's a great question.
I mean, is there any, I suppose probably there are Broadway salaries, but I don't know if that exists anywhere else.
Do you have a day job?
I do not. No. No, but I have a wife who has a day job.
Right. So this is a family unit then that's between the two of you, bringing in enough money to keep the boat afloat, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. And pay the mortgage and keep clothes on Helena's back and food in her stomach.
Right. I don't think our audience knows you have a child as well. How old is she?
I do. She's 10 years old. Yes. She's in fifth grade.
When did you last have a day job?
I think so somewhere in the 90s, I was still bartending during the day. And I stopped because I got a job at Arena Stage and I was doing a show with them at night and I was rehearsing. Oh, I know what it was. I think somebody was fired and I think I took over for her. Yes. Many great careers have happened after somebody.
That's how I got my first job in New York. My boss got fired.
Is that right? and so I started, I couldn't, in other words, do the day job. So I had to say to my wonderful bosses, listen, I've got to take this and I'll come back in a month. And they said, great. And I realized when I did that if I went back, that I needed to cut the day job cord. And so I did. So I never went back to bartending. I did, I delivered papers for a little while. I've coached, other people's.
Wait a minute. You were a paper girl?
I was a paper girl. Yes. Which, I suppose I was a paper woman at that point.
Yes.
not a paper girl.
That is such a theater story.
Well, I do have a question that kind of relates indirectly to the issue of day jobs and making a living. A lot of actors move to New York or Chicago or L.A. because they know that casting directors who also work on TV or in the movies are there. And that obviously opens up opportunities. Is that something you ever thought about, like making that turn into a screen career, which would have involved moving maybe? Or was you just not that interested?
I mean, certainly, I think everybody thinks about that because it really is the best way to to support oneself. There just is no getting around the fact that you make more money on camera, period. You know, over the years, a lot of the income that I've made has been through what Washington I think this is mostly distinct to Washington. So a big market for actors in the area is industrials, and industrials are often training films or educational films, and many of them are for government agencies.
Oh, that's really interesting. And, I knew about industrials, but I didn't know that D.C. was a major center for
it. Is that because of all the government work, I guess?
Yeah, like in other words, like the Postal Service. I know Rick Fauché, another actor in Washington, would do stuff for the Postal Service. It was the training films for people learning how to operate the vehicle, that kind of stuff.
Exactly. I mean, I've spoken utterly unbelievable tax code gobbledygook. and that's the hardest part of them, is always sort of learning this incredible vocabulary where you have to say, wait, is this an acronym that where you say the letters or do you sound it out? And it's quite, so I guess the most recent one I did, I think, was I was a TSA agent.
Oh, no.
So I was in a full TSA uniform, and I was demonstrating how to use one of those machines where you walk in and you stand there with your arms up, as though you're being held at gunpoint or something, and the machine scans your body.
Oh. Forgive me, but I have. This reminds me, back in World War II, John Ford actually directed an army film called Sex Hygiene about venereal disease.
How did you go from
you
the
can
TSA
watch it,
to
you can watch
Terry.
It on YouTube? Well, because I was thinking, did she do searches in this film?
That's hilarious. Well, can we?
I did not. But I will tell you, I haven't done it, but I do know a lot of actors that also do, they do medical. There's a word for it now. I'm blanking on what the word is. They have to sort of research and study a certain disease or something or other, and then they go and trainee doctors in training come and ask them questions and try to diagnose their illnesses.
Oh, that's fascinating.
And that is something that I've never I've never done that one before, but I do know a lot of actors that supplement their income that way.
It's important to note that a fairly recent development in Washington theater is there are now actors in Washington now have agents. There is an agency in Washington representing DC actors. I assume are you with them, Holly?
I am.
So there's become a level of, I think, as this community has become even more accomplished. And Holly was on, for example, House of Cards. I remember her doing an episode of House of Cards. So there, when things film down there, of course they do that. But here's my question, Holly. What does it say, and I've seen you even do stuff in New York. You did a wonderful evening of Beckett plays. But what does it say about this country that an actor of your caliber can say that you can't make a living doing this work? I mean, it has to be a passion. and really, we all rely on your passion to do this because you're not being remunerated at a level that your audience probably is being paid.
I mean, I guess does it sadly say that we just don't appreciate the arts, or further than that, that we don't understand the importance of the arts? And and you know, I mean, theaters, they struggle. And I know that patrons look at the ticket prices and they say, how the hell is this theater, you know, how are they struggling when I'm paying $100 or more for a ticket? And that's here.
Right.
That's not in New York, where right. they're paying, as we know, quite a bit more. So I can only assume that is what it means. That's, I guess, what it sort of feels like. And of course, you know, the interesting part is that you do have people who see a show and say afterwards that that moved me more than I've ever something that I've ever experienced.
Mm.
And what else does that?
Right.
You know.
Did you set out deliberately to be a Washington-based actor? What did you imagine when you got started?
When I came back home after college, I don't think I knew what the theater environment was in Washington. You know, I grew up with my mom was a great lover of theater and grew up outside of New York, and she would go in all the time. And frankly, has seen some of the great, you know, I mean, she, I believe, saw the original Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Oh, my, oh, my, oh, my.
Yeah. And that's just one of many. And so I grew up with my parents taking me to theater. Now, at that time, we went to the National and the Kennedy Center and Arena. And, you know, they, I think, weren't aware of what other theaters were around. It wasn't until I moved back here, and my first job actually was running the wigs. I was wig mistress for a production of Pygmalion at Arena Stage, and with Richard Bauer and Tammy Grimes and Terry Currier and Tana Hicken and Jennifer Mendenhall, all of these great Washington actors who I just got to know. And it was then that I started seeing, you know, what theaters were growing and were there. And at that point, of course, Washington wasn't yet a destination. It was a stopover. It was, I'm going to get a couple of, you know, credits on my resume from the Shakespeare Theater and from Arena Stage, and then I'm going to move to New York, start my career.
That's a very important development you've just told us about, that nowadays there are actors like you in Washington, like any number of actors in Chicago, who really see those cities as the place where they want to work. They don't expect to move on. They don't want to move on. They've made a deeply satisfying career for themselves in a major regional center of theater, and that didn't exist 10, 15 years ago.
That's exactly right. It didn't exist. And now it is, you know, now there are kids who get out of school and they say, I'm going to move to Washington and start a theater company, or I'm going to start my career here. And there are, you know, I mean, there's a lot of incredibly diverse theater to be seen and to be, to be a part of here.
How does it feel to you to have been present at the creation of that kind of theater culture?
I mean, really proud, frankly. I must say the folks that I referred to who put those credits on their resumes and then moved away, a lot of them have come back. And I never left. And I frankly, you know, had they all stayed, maybe I wouldn't have the career that I have now. Because we're talking about a lot of really talented people. And you know, came back for different reasons, I'm sure, because there, you know, there is a community here. I'll bet that Chicago actors would say the same thing, and
sure
Seattle
would.
Actors and San Francisco actors. There's a special community here. There's a special sort of feeling of family. You know, I use this example. I remember years ago I was at Theater J, and I was auditioning for a play, and I can't remember what the play was. And I remember sitting in the lobby waiting to go in and read, and we were all out there just chit-chatting about things, not necessarily about what show was coming up and what are you auditioning for, and I heard so-and-so got that role, but what's going on in your life? And you know, and there was such a feeling, you know, any one of those women, and to be honest, I don't remember who got the role, any one of those women would have been supportive of any other of those women getting the role. It was that feeling of camaraderie, and that we were all in this together. And I feel like that feeling is still here. And I just love that. But I get the feeling from the actors that I've spoken to that is something unique to our community.
Well, that is, you know, I look forward, Holly, now that you talked about Theater J again, to seeing what you do directing Naomi Jacobs and another great Washington actress playing Ruth.
Absolutely.
Playing Ruth Westheimer on the stage is going to be a lot of fun. So thank you so much for spending some time talking to us about your career. We really appreciate it.
And absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you.
Alas, I've been told that podcasts are not meant to go on for hours as much as we would love them to.
Okay.
So we're going to have to move on. Thanks again to Holly Twyford for taking the time to speak with us today from Washington and for reminding us why we're all so invested in theater. Now, as Holly mentioned...
Speaking of invested.
Yes. As Holly mentioned, ticket prices have gotten pretty bad in Washington. And if they're bad in D.C., you can imagine how horrible they are in New York. And they really are horrible. There's no way around it. So now I did not get invited to Bruce Springsteen on Broadway. And that means that I'm not going to see the show because I just don't happen to have hundreds of dollars laying about the house. A friend paid $650 for her seat, and that is face value.
Mm.
That's not a StubHub ticket.
Mm.
That is a real ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the most expensive.
Right. $850 is the top ticket price.
Yes. So $650, so she's probably in the back of the orchestra. And that, I'm sorry, but that is insane. That is completely insane. Tickets, the first row for the last couple of weeks, I think, of Bette Midler's run in Hello, Dolly, are just under
$1,000. $998, like a dress at Macy's. Kind
and, of that, and that... Yeah. Also, you add
99 cents.
Yeah,
add
right, exactly.
Those wonderful fees and charges and restoration gouging that the theaters do, and you're north of $1,000. And then, of course, there's the secondary market where we're talking thousands and thousands of dollars. I think there's a collective loss of sanity here, although defenders of capitalism will say, no, it's totally normal. If there's a demand, why not? And, okay, I guess my question is, why not? And are prices like that worth mentioning in reviews?
Mm. Well, I mean, I didn't review the Springsteen show. Let's go at this from another angle to begin with. I do mention ticket prices. For one thing, listeners may not realize that not only do critics get free tickets, but the tickets don't have a price on them.
Mm.
They say 0000.
Right.
We are... on a day-to-day basis, insulated from the normal consequences of paying for tickets. I always think about this, and when I feel, as a viewer, that there's an incongruity between the value of that show and the price of the ticket, I mention it in the review.
Mm.
I just say, flat out, I don't think this would have been worth paying $150 for an orchestra seat to, or I question whether it would have been. I really try to think about that, and all the more because we don't pay for them. We really have to try to put ourselves in the place of ordinary people for whom going to the theater is a financial sacrifice. And they're the ones who need to be there most of all. So I feel that this goes all the way down from Bruce Springsteen for $1 million a ticket to an off-Broadway show, which is nevertheless, in some cases, priced rather high for ordinary folks.
In the history of criticism, of theater criticism, I don't recall reading a lot of great reviews in which the great critics going down the years from Harold Clurman to Walter Kerr, I don't remember them talking much about the price of tickets. Is this a phenomenon that is basically because we think the prices are now inflated and weren't then?
Well,
or was it commensurate?
That is objectively true. I did a column about this a few years ago using Inflation Calculator, one of the online sites, to try to get a sense of just how far ahead of the cost of living inflation had pushed the prices of tickets. And it's a tremendous margin. Tickets just cost more in constant dollars now than they did even for the hottest shows in the 50s and 60s. Even the big shows like My Fair Lady. Everything has changed. Mm. And that makes it an issue. If you see what we do in theater criticism as having not just an aesthetic aspect, but a journalistic aspect, a cultural aspect, then it's an issue.
I think this reflects the fact that theater, I'm going to venture, theater used to be more part of a daily diet, not daily, but weekly or monthly diet for a New Yorker or someone in Chicago or anywhere, really.
Yes.
And when it's something that you do regularly, it's a kind of basic commodity that you pay for.
And it's especially pronounced in New York, because I also ran those calculations for other cities.
But now theater has been pushed to something you do once a year. It's an event as opposed to something you do on a regular basis. And people are ready to pay more for events. But that completely warps the expectations that one places on theater going. It becomes, you when you pay that money, you are really, I think, preconditioned to love it, and it completely warps the experience of engaging with the show.
It's harder not to feel that you got your money wasted because you feel like you got taken.
I don't know, because I think you get in a mindset where you're like, I paid that much money, I'm going to love it no matter what.
I think that's part of what drives the standing ovation epidemic in New York.
I feel a little as if it's a slippery slope, that once you go down that path of everything has to be evaluated for its economic value, that you are then sort of compelled to always talk about its economic value. And I don't know that that's my strong suit in trying to judge what other people think is valuable.
Right.
I saw Hamilton off Broadway, where the prices were probably fairly reasonable, and that experience was pre-hysteria over the prices for Hamilton, which changed the conversation outside in the world about the show. But does that really affect the artistic merit of what you saw on that stage?
Oh,
was it appreciably more valuable because you saw it at a cheaper price at the Public Theater?
No, that would be a pure Marxist analysis.
That's right. How does one calculate this? Is it that it was worth it at the Public Theater, but possibly not worth it at the Richard Rodgers? Do we make these distinctions, and why do theater critics have, English majors and the like, have any notion about the economics of people's tastes?
Only when there's a perceived incongruity do I mention it.
Okay.
That's where I think
when it's way out of whack,
the alarm bell goes off. For me, at least.
But I was looking, for instance, I went online and I was looking at the orchestra, the prices for orchestra seats for some of those shows. And for instance, in March 2018, I could buy a mezzanine seat for Hamilton for $285.
Right.
Mezzanine.
Right.
Hello Dolly. Also, it becomes really personal. I mean, this is all the beauty of dynamic pricing. So the $998 is for the front row, but those last few weeks of Bette Midler's run, the orchestra seat is $229, which is the new normal now it's raising the bar up. But that price goes down to $169 when Bernadette Peters comes in.
Right.
Boy, that makes it an economic question, doesn't it?
Yes.
So now we're getting into, okay, so Bette Midler versus Bernadette Peters. I find it hard not to think about it.
And here's the paradox. When a show like Hamilton becomes this hot, or Springsteen, or Dolly, it does. You would think that the retail shopper would say, you know, too much money. I'm going to go see two other shows on Broadway that are less expensive, and have a weekend of it. But no, what's happened is that the complaining from producers is that they suck all the air out of the rest of Broadway because people save up all their dollars to see the one superheated hit. It's almost, you know, counterintuitive. One would think that you could price yourself out of the market and therefore make room for other shows that are cheaper. But it doesn't really work that way.
And this suggests that there must be some kind of, at least as a thought experiment, some kind of solution
right.
that is on some level going to equalize demand
yes.
by giving access
right.
to the hot shows.
Right.
So this is something I know that you and I have
yes.
both been thinking about.
Right, I have been thinking about it. And I don't think it's just... particular to Broadway, I think this works all the way down the line with things in demand. I mean, it has to be shows that have some commercial demand or even some heat around them, even in short runs outside of New York. But I do think that there's something to be said for a philosophy where you front load the costs of tickets, that in the early part of a run for the early adapters, the people who really must see it to be able to talk to other people about it before they've seen it, there should be a premium maybe paid for the tickets in the early part of the run. And once the show has recouped, once it's made its money back, which, and I know that, you know, producers will say they have to maximize the return to their investors. That's their number one loyalty. But what about if shows, you know, reach that payback point where their investors have made their money back and then the prices sort of shoot down? That then it becomes a more available ticket to other people, or at least parts of the theater become $75 or $100 seats as opposed to $600 or $700. And why doesn't Springsteen do this, for example? Because I can't believe that Springsteen on Broadway cost a fortune to produce.
Why do it? What's the incentive for them to do it once they're recouped? Then it's like, it's free money, it's gravy. Why would
I'm saying that we're talking
prices?
About for the good of the theater. Yes, it requires some idealism,
the
altruism
theater.
On the part of a
The good of the
producer.
Theater, which is what everybody producer thinks about, the good of the theater.
All right, but here's where my solution comes in, which is more radical, but also aimed at the disparate effects of these two motivations you're talking about. I was reading a book about Arturo Toscanini, the great Italian conductor few months ago, and it talked about when he was conducting the BBC Symphony back in the 30s, they couldn't sell their tickets because the BBC is a public trust. So they had a lottery for all of the tickets, and they were all free. And there were 10 people trying to get every ticket in the lottery. And I thought to myself, okay, take a show like Hamilton, take a show like the Springsteen show. On certain selected nights, maybe for the entire run, make the entire balcony free by lottery and then dynamically price the rest of the house to pick up the slack from the money you lost on the balcony.
And you mean then make a day of lotteries?
Well, there you could work it in any number of
because
ways.
Because you have to find a way not to make those tickets
right.
scalped.
No, you'd,
for,
have,
you know.
You'd have to think through that. But the point would be that you would both be giving access straight up free access to these very hot shows to people who are never going to get a chance to see them. But at the same time, the producers can really net in by kicking the price up in the orchestra to $1,000 a seat.
See, I don't think that's going to work because the producers right now can get money for their super expensive orchestra and for the balcony and for the mezzanine and for the, you know, standing partial view, standing room. Mm-hmm. By the women's room.
Ah, but if they're making five times as much money on the orchestra with this plan, then they really can be bringing in money and afford to make this spectacular public relations gesture of giving away the balcony.
You know what they're going to do? They're going to charge five times for the orchestra and still charge for the mezzanine because that's what they do. I really think they're ruthless and soulless.
Let's give them a chance to do something different. That is my thinking, that... Because we're joking about how it's good for the theater, but it is good for the theater. That is the point, it is good for creating an audience. It is an investment.
Yes. Correct. It's not just about this show, right?
Because we are. What is the effect of? Why should we be bothered by high ticket prices? Because they've created an artificial situation in which ordinary folks cannot go to the theater just for fun, just tonight, just to say, you know, I hear that show's kind of good. Let's give it a go. Mm.
So obviously we could go on and on, but alas, we need to wrap this up. Before we say goodbye, though, we're each going to mention a distinctive show we've seen recently, a show that's still playing that I quite like. The revival of Time and the Conways that The Roundabout is doing, directed by Rebecca Teichman. I think we're going to have a discussion about that because I think some of you guys really did not like it.
I like the play. I like Priestley. I did not like the production at all.
Well, why is that? I loved it.
I felt like the play got lost in the production, and it also got lost on that stage. The Roundabout American Airlines Theater, which has got a 40-foot wide stage opening, is, for me at least, beginning to become a show eater, something where they're just using too wide a proscenium to put shows that need some more focus.
I completely agree with that. I mean, that's theater is a problem.
And I'm sorry, I like Elizabeth McGovern. She's got a lovely stage presence, but I didn't know what the hell she was doing in this performance. It just made no sense to me.
Oh,
who
really?
I liked was Stephen Boyer from Hand to God, whom we're now seeing as a monstrous Uriah Heepish type, and he's got the range.
We should say that Time in the Conways is set in 1919 and 1938. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of, at the time, probably fairly experimental idea that
it was revolutionary back then,
in which we look at the deterioration of a family post-war and pre-war. By Priestley, who also did an Inspector Calls. We just need to, I think, give context for people out there why we're being
we're seeing, I think,
both here and in England,
we're seeing a kind of a mini Priestley revival. Mm-hmm. He was, in the 30s and 40s, one of England's most popular playwrights and novelists.
Mm-hmm. He's fairly unknown here. I mean, I really tremendously enjoyed that production. I thought it was subtle and very well balanced, actually, the ensemble. I thought was very well balanced.
Well, that's why the three of us are sitting here. We don't agree on
is
almost
that
anything.
Why?
Yes. let me quickly talk about two things I've seen. One of them in Washington, directed by Rachel Chavkin, who is a director of the moment in New York for The Great Comet. But she's directed a new play in Washington at Roundhouse Theater, actually in Bethesda, Maryland, called I'll Get You Back Again, by a young player named Sarah Gancher. And the good news is that in the regions we're getting, you know, in a place like Washington, we're getting a first-class director working on a play that isn't really ready. And the other show I wanted to talk about is one that just opened in New York. It's Second Stage Theater. It's a revival of Harvey Fierstein's originally called Torch Song Trilogy, now shortened to Torch Song. I don't know why.
Shortened by an hour and a half.
Well, yeah, mercifully. But I thought that the central performance given by a young actor that you may have heard of named Michael Urie is truly astonishing.
Best known, I think, for most people from
Ugly Betty.
Yeah.
Right. He's done some other great things in New York. He was in Byron Cellar, which was a wonderful one-man show. He's also just finished up in The Government Inspector off-Broadway. He's a comic actor of incredible range, and I thought more moving even than Harvey in the role, in the central role.
Whoa. Oh, my God. Okay. I'm going to say that I think Michael Urie is so completely miscast in Torch Song that it wrecked the entire show for me. I could barely stand to look at it. He's completely wrong for the role. And I love Michael Urie. I love The Government Inspector.
I'm a great fan of his.
I love Byron Cellar. He's a very inventive actor. But he's just wrong for this part. He's just completely wrong.
I do want to say, though, that I'm fascinated by how we receive the play now and how it holds up. It now comes across to me. I mean, back then, it was quite revolutionary. It now plays to me like a Neil Simon play.
Absolutely. Parts of it do.
And part of why Harvey was so good is because even though he's funny, he didn't play it that way. He played it with great intensity and with a contradiction between that froggy voice and the anger and the sentiment in it. And I didn't feel that. I felt that Urie's performance was all of a piece and a bit one notey.
I think a really big problem is that the character, there is a soupçon of, there's the sense of self-deprecation. For the show starts with him saying, you know, I was never young and beautiful. I'm sorry, but Michael Yeori is young and beautiful.
There are a lot of things there, in the text that are Firestein specific.
When he says,
talking about his size.
And his voice. Do you have a cold? Well, Michael Yeori, you sound like an angel. You don't have a cold ever.
I don't know that
I'd have changed the text.
I don't know that people who are young and beautiful necessarily think of themselves as young and beautiful. So I think that's a little bit, transparent for me to understand who this person is and has got many different layers. And I thought I understood the relationship between between Yuri's character and Mercedes Rule as mom was brilliantly revealed.
Boy, she comes on like gangbusters, doesn't she?
Oh, see, I thought she was very subtle. I thought it was
I mean, good though. Good.
Good.
She's like a bulldozer.
I felt like the night I saw it, the audience was completely like semi-comatose and came alive as soon as Mercedes Rule entered.
Mark
the
my
show
words.
This came alive.
Mark my words. This will end up on Broadway.
I wouldn't
be
surprised.
Oh, my God, please, no.
It's the right moment for the play. Speaking of getting to Broadway, I just got off the road. I guess I'm the first critic on the East Coast to have seen the first production on the East Coast
of
Shakespeare in Love, the stage version, which is being done at the Shakespeare Theater of New Jersey. It's directed by Bonnie J. Monti, who's the artistic director there. I went in with a chip on my shoulder about the size of a redwood. It works. It works the way she did it. I don't know whether a different kind of production, a Disney-fied production, would work. But in a 340-seat house, they built an Elizabethan-style open stage theater up on the stage, a duplicate. They play it, again, right down the middle. It's not slick. It's not pretty. The script is just the dialogue from the film, so it takes a lot of directing. But when you do it in front of an audience like this, it works better than the film.
We should say it's the most produced work.
That's right.
According to American Theater Magazine.
According to American Theater, 15 times this season versus, I think, 8 for the most popular Shakespeare play. Isn't that right, Dee? Something like Twelfth Night was the second most popular. But anyway, it works. It works really well. I didn't expect it to. We know this is coming to New York because Disney Theatrical Productions is behind it. And what I have been told, and this is just gossip, but it's informed gossip, is they're not imposing a uniform production style on these 15 productions. Mm. They're letting everybody do it their own way and trying to figure out how the show should be brought into New York.
It sounds interesting, but I have very little interest in seeing this. I don't know. I don't get the phenomenon.
I hate commodity theater. I went expecting to blitz the show.
What's commodity theater?
Well, it's theater where a proven commodity, like a hit film, is back transformed into a stage show. Repurposing for the purpose of making money.
That's different. This is actual.
No, this is a real phenomenon. Yeah. It's one that I think is very bad for theater. It's been bad for the musical. I thought this show would be terrible. Instead, I was completely charmed by it. Mm. You never know, and boy, is that something that should be over our bathroom mirrors as critics. You never know.
Right. Right.
That should be it for today. We're looking forward to chatting some more next month. Until then, I'm Elizabeth Vincentelli.
I'm Terry Teachout.
I'm Peter Marks. And you've been listening to Three on the Isle, a podcast from New York about theater in America, hosted by American Theater Magazine.
Our producers are Kirby Pate and Deep Tron. You can follow us on Twitter at Three on the Isle. That's T-H-R-E-E on the Isle. And write to us at threeontheisle@gmail.com.
Let us know what you think and what you'd like to hear on future podcasts.
Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you on the aisle.